Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome to another episode of Living Well with Kathleen Saunders, your weekly podcast where we discuss the financial, physical, spiritual, and social well-being of everyday people like you and me. The information shared in this show is for general information purposes only and should not be used to make any personal changes to your lifestyle or health without consulting the appropriate financial, medical, or healthcare professionals. David A. Hill. David is president and partner of Enerready Products Limited, a residential ventilation equipment manufacturer. He has worked in the residential ventilation industry for 39 years and co-founded TECA 30 years ago and is president for the 2019-2020 term. Over the last 25 years, he has spoken at over 40 conferences throughout the US and Canada on the topics of residential ventilation, the principles of moving air, and chimney safety. In 2017, he was awarded honorary membership in Haven. All right. Welcome, David, and thank you for being my guest today.
Pleasure, Kathleen. Happy to talk about something that's dear to my heart.
Awesome. I am so looking forward to hear you share with us and speak on the topic of ventilation, air movement, and air quality. So tell me, David, how is good ventilation system important for our health?
That is the key question of this whole topic. Our building or our home is an island in a sea of air that surrounds us, so that the air in a residence in 99% of the cases is of a lower quality than that of the ocean of air around us, because we're living in it, cooking in it, showering and using that air and degrading it as the normal process of living in that house. Or in the case of a commercial building, it's even more extreme because the occupant density is higher. So the bottom line is in Vancouver, we have some pretty darn good air quality overall, although it tends to degrade as you get towards the eastern part of the valley and places like Chilliwack, it's actually quite dirty. Mm-hmm. But in Vancouver itself, the closer you get to the water, the cleaner the air is.
Right.
However, when you're in a building, whether it's a commercial building or a residence, the air quality by and large is lower, and that we need to provide an air exchange in the building, and that's an exchange with outdoors, that is appropriate for the intended occupancy of the building, so it's always maintained at a level. And if you have enough money, you can raise it to a level of quality better than that of the ocean of air that surrounds us. So the concept of ventilation is, in most cases, providing an air exchange, not air circulation, mm-hmm. but an air exchange with outdoors to elevate your indoor quality to that at least equal to that of outdoors.
I see.
The difficulty we face in houses is they're extreme from a moisture point of view, in that the cooking and the showering, and believe it or not, just the breath from people actually adds quite a bit of moisture to the building. And if you're in a coastal climate where the outdoor air has got quite a bit of moisture to start with, this can build up to levels where it gets too high. And that's one of the challenges and one of the needs of ventilation. In fact, it's in the BC Building Code, quite stringently written since 2012, requiring that we have a continuous air exchange in a home and that it's distributed to the bedrooms, because that room is the single most important room in the home to have this air exchange go on continually.
So tell me, how can we improve the ventilation quality in our home?
Well, here's the challenge to the question, how can we improve the air quality? The technology is very, very simple. We have a bigger problem about this, and it's a social problem, is that here in Canada, we are unfortunately too commonly believe that our health is a state or a social responsibility and one that we don't take seriously ourselves. So in the case of ventilation, I don't think very many people really look at ventilation seriously, except three groups of people. Mm. You get people that are in the medical profession. They recognize that an air exchange is healthy. You get people from Europe. They also recognize this, and I can get into the reasons why if you're curious. Or people with respiratory problems, the allergies, the asthma, and things where they react in a respiratory weakness, which is one of my personal problems. And I think that what's happened is that generally speaking, if we were to speak to ventilation to the average person on the street, they'd be completely unaware of its importance. They certainly wouldn't be willing to pay for it. And in probably 75% of the cases, people would be so oblivious of it, they would confuse air circulation with that of air exchange without doors, which, of course, is what ventilation is all about.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, why are people in Europe more concerned about the quality of ventilation, the seriousness
very, very
of ventilation?
Go ahead. And having been to Europe three or four times and really spent a lot of time with our mentors, because Europe has a generation lead on us in an appreciation of ventilation on the average person in the street. When you have a combination of smaller dwelling units, ridiculous placed energy, you end up with a conservation energy mentality of closing up a building. And when you have a family size that's, say, what we would have here, you have occupant densities that are higher, and some of the problems of the mold and the mildew, and these are much more, should I say, on the tips of people's tongue in Europe than they are here, where we've had dirt cheap energy, wood frame buildings, which tend to have ridiculous out of control leakage rates. And the lower density just means to say we are not reaching the levels of humidity which cause these chronic mold and mildew problems that have been so evident in Europe. And while they do exist here, they're not as common. And where they exist, people blame it on the heating system rather than the true cause. The example for being, if you were living in an electric heated apartment or townhouse or single detached building, electric heated dwelling units tend to be built tighter because there's a full appreciation of the cost is higher. You have higher insulation levels, higher degree of tightness, and therefore the mold and the mildew problems are much, much more acute in electric heated residences, although the public tends to blame the heat as to the cause of the mold and the mildew and the high moisture level, rather than the true cause is that they just aren't breathing enough for the occupants.
I see. Wow.
If you want a good laugh, all you have to do is go stay in cheap motels in Vancouver Island, which are all electrically heated, which is what everything was heated there until about 30 years ago, 20 years ago, when gas came over there. That's where you have the really, really chronic problems in our neck of the woods, because electric has no chimneys. It's expensive, and people tend to close up to much greater diligence than they would when there's gas, which at today's rates is a third of the price of that electricity.
True. Yeah, that's so true. Wow.
Yeah, anyone mm-hmm. today that heats with electricity has got rocks in their head. When you have access to natural gas at today's rate, which is a third that than it is of electricity, and even within our residence, the carbon tax is actually higher than the cost of commodity that we're running through our furnace. Even with that penalty, our per BTU or per unit of energy which we're heating our house with, it's exactly one-third that would be if we had been using electricity.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I see here, I was just reading this article that you had. It said that the system may also incorporate air filtration, which can arrest airborne particles. Can you speak a little bit more on that?
Okay, let's shift gears completely.
Okay, sure.
In ventilation, which I've gone over here for the last few minutes, that's an exchange of air with outdoor air. And into that discussion, I have not brought the word filtration on the assumption that by and large, our outdoor air is of higher quality. Now, when you get into the filtration issue, you're in a whole different level of technology. One of the three main ways in which you can improve air quality in a building, but you can filter. And then when you filter, then you can filter the outdoor air coming in, so you can remove all the pollens and things like that. Although in our HVAC systems and residents today, filtration is typically thought to be included with the forced air heating system. And that's where it's blurred in the public mind. They believe a forced air heating system is ventilation, which is not. A forced air heating system circulates air around the house and then adds heat as the building requires it. So when we speak of filtration at a lay level, we're usually referring to a filter that we would put into that furnace system. Mm-hmm. The problem, however, comes historically. The filters that we used, some people are derogatorily calling them doormats, or rock catchers, are what we call equipment protection, and it's there so that you can prolong the life of your, or should I say, delay the service life, the service frequency of your equipment by taking out the big particles, and that equipment would be, those filters would typically be called like MERV 3 or 4, very, very low in the scale. To properly use the word filtration, then we have to look no longer at equipment protection, but at human health. And we know that we need to get the particles out of the air that, you know, the MERV filters like 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. So we're taking out respirable particles, which you simply can't do properly with equipment protection. So just to sort of summarize that, equipment protection is the low end of filtration. These MERV filters are really there to remove what we call lung damaging particles. Mm-hmm. And then that, of course, is completely different from ventilation, which is an air exchange, which may or may not have filtering in that. The public really, really chokes and struggles on this because, to me and the people in our industry, it's very, very elementary. But at the lay level, there's huge confusion between these two air-improving technologies.
I see, right. I'm just reading here from your article that you sent me. The heating and ventilation installation are not generally inspected. I wanted to talk a little bit on that.
Don't even get me going on that. In BC, as in all provinces in Canada, the building inspector, city and municipality, is legally charged, and certainly in BC's case, under the Municipal Act, with inspecting a building when it's new built, whether it's commercial building or residential building. My expertise is residential. Mm-hmm. And that building inspector, when you pull a permit, is obliging himself for the permit fees that are paid to perform an inspection to ensure that that house is compliant with the BC Building Code. Well, we have two problems. One problem is when ventilation first came into the BC Building Code in 1987, because I was involved right back in 1980, I've been involved with every code sequence since, and they're usually updated every 5 years. We've gone from extremely crude codes, which just basically required a bathroom fan and a bathroom, to the point today where we have two major steps forward in residential ventilation. One is the system has to run continually, and number two, we have to provide an air exchange in the bedroom. The bedroom being the most important room in the house because it's small, you're in there for extended times and the door's often closed, and those all compound to making air quality there more important than any other room of the house. So the second issue is while in BC now, throughout the whole province, with the single exception of the City of Vancouver, which has its own charter and hence its own building code, we've required since 2012 with small modifications called amendments in 2014, 2015, to where we require that continuous system and it requires it to provide air exchange in the bedroom. The problem, however, is within the Building Inspector Industry Association, where they now have level 1, 2, and 3 qualifications required to perform the role of building inspection. By and large, in Canada at least, the skill level required to be a good building inspector is scattered over so many different facets that generally speaking in BC today, with very few exceptions, these building inspectors are not adequately trained or aware of the heating and the ventilation part of a building. And that is a huge issue today that we haven't yet really resolved in this province today, unlike in Sweden where they've separated off plumbing and heating and ventilation under a separate permit, separate inspection, people qualified in the mechanical trades. We haven't yet reached that level now, although the City of Vancouver is now contemplating hiring someone for heating and ventilating inspection for January of next year.
Oh, wow.
Kelowna has done it for a while, but generally inspections on that area are very weak. New Westminster is coming on strong right now, which is kind of neat to see. And I think this group is waking up to recognizing that heating and ventilating are important and are now treating it seriously, which is something that all of us in our industry welcome.
Wow.
It's a big, huge change for them because there's so much going on now with building envelopes, you know, and thermal performance and all this kind of stuff. We're developing huge expertise in that community and certainly amongst building inspectors in that part of building. But mechanical has been very much lagging, We simply don't have overall good technical expertise amongst building officials in that area. But like I say, it's coming on strong now, and I think the COVID has probably been some good for us in making people a bit more aware in that regard.
Right. And speaking of COVID, can that be spread through the building ventilation system?
Well, again, commercially, I'm not as strong as residentially,
okay.
But I do recognize that ASHRAE is considered in North America and to some degree in the world an expert on building mechanical systems, and we've been members of ASHRAE now for 30 years and attend many, many of their meetings. If this COVID is spread by particles, one could argue that there's a very good value and improving the ventilation, because ventilation is dilution with outdoor air, which presumably is less at risk to someone that's, should I say, immune compromised. It could also be argued that filtration of the existing air would be a big advantage as well. The difficulty is that most people have not got filters in a residence, at least at a level which would be anywhere near capable of taking out the moisture-carrying droplets of the COVID. And as a result, the air circulation system in most residents would do nothing to arrest it. The ventilation would help a little bit by dilution, but from what I know today, it would take ventilation and circulation with good filtration to do the best that we know of at this moment. COVID virus apparently is very, very small, something in the order of like 0.1 of a micron. That is so small, we're almost incapable of getting it out except with the very, very best filters out there. However, when it is attached to moisture droplets of, say, a sneeze, it's 10 times bigger, and we're certainly very, very capable of taking that out with filters that most furnaces could withstand if they were put in properly. And by withstand, I mean that aren't choking the furnace to the point it's going to cook its brains out and self-destruct.
Well, okay, that's good to know.
Sort of like if you put 3 or 4 masks on, you wouldn't be able to breathe. Well, that's what's happening today. If you put a really good filter in an average furnace, suffocate it. But while it's consuming gas, it's just going to burn itself up and shut down. And this is really, really bad for equipment when you overly zealously put in high efficiency or high MERV filters into a system that isn't properly designed for it.
I hear you. Right, gotcha. Tell me, the home ventilation system, how does that help reduce odors when we have the ventilation system in place?
Oh, real easy. Odors are basically two things. Cooking and use of the toilet are those the two dominant ones. But what people forget is people produce odor, moisture, and carbon dioxide just because of little weak combustion appliances running around the house. So, and there's two methods of controlling odor. The one that's most commonly used is ventilation, and that is you exhaust the points of the odor, which is the bath and the kitchen. So 24 hours a day, you're removing that air because it's thoroughly spent and it's worthy of the energy cost to remove it. At the same time, you're bringing fresh air back in, you're stuffing it into the bedroom and the living room, and that way you're using dilution, which is what ventilation is all about. But by the removal of that which is truly spent, you've got the leverage advantage of getting rid of that which is bad and putting fresh air back into the rooms, which is those that you'd be in for most of your occupied hours.
Okay.
There are other things you can do, which came up in the fire season, where you have outdoor air that really, really suffered from bad odor, and that's getting into carbon absorption. But that isn't as commonly used in the average residence, but it can be used if you're in an area of wood smoke, you're in an area of cattle manure, you're in an area that's high traffic with odor from vehicles. You can get into carbon filtration, which is extremely effective, but generally speaking, not warranted. Although we were deluged with calls during the fire season because the outdoor air was just so smoke laden, it was really respiratory stress for some people. And certainly as a bicyclist, I know my capacity was down during the months of really, really bad smoke. I just simply could not perform like I would normally.
Can you speak on the air leakage that can no longer be counted on to meet our fresh air needs. What did you...
Oh, boy. Don't get me going on that one. There is a false belief out that why the hell should we be tightening up houses and then forcing the public to pay for a properly operating ventilation system? Why don't we go back to 30 years ago when houses leaked like sieves and the ventilation was built into the structure? It's completely wrong logic, and here's why. When the public says that, out of ignorance, and I'm sure that us in the home building industry have contributed to the spreading of that falsity, what happens is when you have a multiple-story house, it's in a windy location, and it's cold outside, you can get a really high air exchange just due to the wind blowing in through your leaky plug-ins and all sorts of crazy things. Electrical panels and outside wall are one classic source of air exchange. But what the public doesn't understand is this is a huge compromise to thermal comfort and a ridiculous waste of energy when you build at that standard. Mm-hmm. The public today demands comfort, and you can only have comfort if you go out of your way to buffer yourselves with a proper wall between what's cold and windy outside and inside.
Right.
The other thing is that for 50 years, this province has used natural gas for house boilers and house furnaces. And what no one wants to tell you is that these chimneys have providing 50 or 60 or 70 cubic feet per minute of exhaust air from the basement of the houses. And this has been going on for 50 years, forcing air to come in to replace it. So most houses that were on natural gas up until a few years ago had a ventilation system riding free without the public being aware of it with the heating system.
Mm.
It leads to the myth that if you have forced air heating, you don't need ventilation, which is no longer true because chimneys today are almost extinct from buildings.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So we're better off with our air quality.
Here, mm-hmm. The public is in a complete state of confusion.
Yeah, sounds that way.
Another thing that is sort of related to this, that's one of my pet peeves, is that at the moment, or at least so far, I've discussed ventilation for the purposes of providing, you know, improvement of air quality in a building to matching that of outdoors, and with filters, you can improve it beyond. And I've been identifying the principal culprit, or the principal degrading of air in a residence anyway, comes from human occupancy. Well, one of my pet peeves is that we have a rising damp phenomena, which is going on the lower mainland and many other places in the province, where when you build a house and you build its footing, which is what carries the weight of the whole house, and it's concrete and it's bearing on what we call undisturbed soil, that concrete is capable of wicking water up for the life of the house. And so many houses today, and I've been into scores of houses, mm-hmm. where you have rising damp, which can make a marginally underventilated house acutely underventilated and bring in major mold and mildew problems because it was never built right to start with.
Oh, wow.
And I find this very, very frustrating because the building industry is unaware of this right now, of rising damp, and our codes are hopelessly, and I stress hopelessly, inadequate to dealing with this ongoing problem, which is only made worse when we add energy efficiency measures to current buildings.
Hmm. So, David, do you think this rise in damp could be the cause of why more and more children or people on a whole are getting allergies such as asthma and eczema?
My personal belief right now is that forgetting about the whole issue of pharmaceuticals, which is another sore point with me, but I'm not qualified to speak on, I can be absolutely confident right now that if you build a house with what I call dry feet and you ventilate it, I have anecdotal evidence right now from people who contact us verbally and in writing how much their health of their kids is improved with a proper dry foundation and a very small continuous air exchange that gets air to bedrooms.
Mm.
That's why I've been such a strong proponent as chair of the provincial's ventilation committee as part of TECA, been pushing for small systems, carefully installed air exchange to bedrooms that never stop. And that took us almost 30 years from concept to getting it into the code because of how strongly we and the members of our committee believe it to be.
Wow, that's serious. Is there anyone that's going around? Is that something that you do? Go around to these builders and inform them when they're building the foundation. Does anyone inform them and let them know?
I have an entire slideshow that I've used to builders, to building inspectors. Building inspectors have a conference. Generally, it's in Richmond, but it's been all over the province every year. And I've been speaking once every year to them on different topics, one of which is the control of humidity in a building. I've also spoken to the Home Builders Association, have their meetings provincially anyway at the Hyatt downtown, or at least it was last year. And I speak regularly on this. The difficulty we face is that in home building, HGTV is what sells the building. And what they present there is purely sizzle. In fact, one of my standing jokes is in front of the Home Builders Association, I say we should take all the producers of HGTV, hang them up by the toenails and shoot them because they're giving the public a false expectation of what they should get and stressing purely visual with zero concern for the long-term health and safety of that building. And I just go ballistic. And the last time I dropped this one at the Sheraton Villa or whatever it's called today, the Delta Villa, I was actually surprised the 100 home builders. I actually got a good laugh out of them because it was a direct attack at their industry. But they are just as much pawns as we are to what HGTV presents to the buying public today.
Wow. I'm not sure if you discussed the different types of the ventilations. I see you say there's a natural ventilation and the mechanical ventilation.
Okay.
Can you explain
the difference between that? Mm-hmm. Natural ventilation is a misnomer. It implies good, green, healthy, and all that garbage. Natural ventilation is a house that's completely out of control, subject to the wind and what we call stack action, which is air coming in at the bottom, leaving the top. There's absolutely nothing natural about natural ventilation. It's a complete bogus term that has been propagated on our belief of green and all that goes with it. And I'm not, I mean, I'm green to a point, but practical. But natural is, like I say, completely bogus. Mechanical ventilation is the idea of mechanically bringing air in prescribed, very small quantities, distributing to the bedrooms. And you will never get that with natural techniques because the wind and the outdoor to indoor temperature difference is never a constant. And therefore, you can never use that as a motive power provide the small continuous exchange that we need.
Okay.
So never, ever, ever use the word natural. I prefer to use the word raw and uncontrolled ventilation as opposed to control, because only with control can you mitigate runaway energy bills and discomfort. And people today would never tolerate the discomfort that occurred in houses 50 years ago. You're demanding thermal comfort right now.
Right.
And the biggest ingredient of thermal comfort is a building that's well-built that keeps out the winter.
Sure, yes. Okay. And the mechanical?
Mechanical is a big, huge general term, but in very simple terms, it's using a very small but very high-quality fan to remove air, and in some cases, a twin or a very small mechanical fan to bring air in. But all mechanical ventilation systems for dwelling units has a minimum of one fan. And if you have enough money in your budget, you get two.
Okay. Good to know that. What are the signs of a home ventilation rate that is maybe too low?
My answer is going to be sort of backwards.
Okay.
In 40 years of this business, selling ventilation has been a pig. And we stood in front of hundreds and hundreds of the public and in home shows for 30 years straight, you know, 100 hours nonstop home show talking about ventilation. It's almost impossible to convey ventilation and the merits of it to people outside of the three that I identify, which is the medical, the Europeans, and the respiratory challenge people. The The best example I can use is if a person's lived in a ventilated home where they're always having a gradual air exchange, people come back to us and tell us they'll never build one without it again.
Right.
And they become so aware of the less than good air quality when they visit their neighbors or friends or relatives. People's noses are asleep. I went out with a hike yesterday for Jem for 8 hours. And I go through the different places in the forest and I can smell the different trees.
Mm-hmm.
The species, the marshes, the pine forests, when the sun hits some shady areas, they all smell differently. And it's beautiful. But you'll get 95% of the people out in the world today will have zero recognition of air quality in a building, much less the subtleties of what you smell in nature.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. Yeah. Wow. What are some of the signs that a home ventilation rate is too high and going the other way now?
Okay, this gets into the sort of the third issue here, the fourth issue. There was a wonderful lady, a doctor, Stephanie Taylor, that spoke to us at ASHRAE earlier this year, pre-COVID, or maybe it was late last year. And her whole specialty is this very interesting medical doctor. She's really a practical type of doctor that's been all over Africa doing, you know, rudimentary medicine of all types. But she got so ticked off at the lousy buildings and the lousy hospitals that she worked at,
mm-hmm.
she decided to park her medical career and go back and study to become an architect. Now, the message that she dropped on this audience, and I was probably one of about 40, 50 engineers, and we just dropped on our butts with her comments. Generally speaking, people who build and mechanical engineers who study buildings are aware of the damage caused when you have too high humidity, because it causes problems of mold and mildew and damage to the building. So generally speaking, builders and that of the mechanical industry tends to look at, let's keep the humidity down out of the danger zone because we don't want to trash the building, and that's our expertise and that's how we're judged.
Mm-hmm.
What she did and dropped us on our butts, and she said here that we have very good evidence that our post-operative infection rate is hugely tied, massively tied, statistically evident tied to the relative humidity of the patient post-operative condition. And what she's saying is that when the humidity, the relative humidity indoors gets less than 40%, 35 being the curve just drops off vertically, well, it goes up vertically, the post-operative infection becomes outrageously large. And it appears that the rationale behind this is when the relative humidity is high, our infectious transmittable diseases attached to moisture droplets tend to fall quite quickly. They leave the respiratory zone or occupied zone, and our reinfection rates are much lower. So what she's basically saying is that we need to keep a building between 40% and 60%, and that's one of the huge problems we have today in the north, especially, is keeping 40% for two reasons. Number one is we're overventilating where we do have ventilation, reducing the humidity because that's easily done in cold weather. But also in cold weather, you have a building that leaks tends to run away more quickly. And those two factors are making it difficult for us to maintain the required minimum humidity in the cold climate. And it can become acutely a problem in older buildings, we have cold corners due to poor building construction where humidity levels, relative humidity levels, at, you know, 40 and 50% will cause mold. So when you try to maintain health in this 40%, 60%, which is a pretty defendable range to keep humidity, in fact, Class A museums require 50%. If you can't maintain it plus or minus 2%, you don't get my exhibit. That's written in contracts for expensive exhibits. But we know that human health is definitely better, and this was studied at length, in fact, quite a few years ago, and it's just kind of interesting to see that research surface, and Dr. Stephanie Taylor just putting the icing on the cake with her own evidence being statistically valid, showing that this 40% minimum is important. Well, we always knew that 60% was also damaging.
I see, right.
So it's an interesting target. The problem we've got in BC today residentially is that we're not very smart and that our building code requirement for ventilation is not tailored to climate, no pun on tailor, because in Tofino, we need 3 times more air exchange to control normal occupant-produced moisture than we do in Dawson Creek. And that's an issue that we have not yet advanced our codes in recognizing that.
Is there anyone that looking at, into that issue?
Well, the TECA Association, which I'm very much involved, last year's president, this year I've just been relegated to committee chair in the Ventilation Committee, which I've been for the last 15 years. We have a proposal before the provincial government right now to advance our BC Building Code with what we call baby steps to deal with these issues. But the politics of this suck right now because the national people are bulldozing their way in with harmonization, which will likely completely close the doors on BC advancing in small baby steps with the next code cycle. And we're fighting to try to bring some small further advancements in because you can do it provincially faster than federally, but we're not sure how this is going to be resolved right now, and that's still up in the air.
Wow, so you're going to have a big fight on your hands there then.
Well, I can see it happening already. I took a call for an hour and 15 minutes late last week on why we should be supporting harmonization with really lousy technical defenses for it. It was politically motivated totally.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, this is really good information that you're sharing with us, and I'm sure a lot of listeners have never heard of this.
No, they won't. Because there is no economic motivation to bring this message to buyers today. The builders, by and large, are putting in ventilation as a grudge purchase because they have to, not because they understand it or want it. You'll only find that 2% of the builders out there have ventilation in their own home, which actually is functional, effective exchange, and they will sell it, but they won't bust themselves because the public is not coming to them with predisposition of understanding the value of a good building and the thermal comfort it brings, nor the wonderful improvement to air quality that a good heating and ventilating system with filtration can provide.
Well, so it's because buyers, home buyers aren't really aware. They're just settling with whatever the bare minimum is. But those of us that are now educated, when we go to the building inspector, we can request the ventilation system be put in.
Here's the problem. Our company, EnerReady Products, is made a focus of custom homes for 40 years because in the custom home market, the owner can influence the builder and get something more than legal minimum code requirement.
Yes.
In spec building, the spec builder is building at the lowest first cost. He's selling on a square foot basis and on a location and sizzle, and he has zero interest in doing more than the absolute minimum that he can get away with the code and what inspection may be offered in that jurisdiction.
Wow.
That's why in New Westminster, for example, our TECA organization, which represents residential heating contractors, heating and ventilating contractors, has been so openly supporting inspection in New Westminster because they finally decided, let's do something properly. And as a result, we sent out 10 warning level letters and offered one suspension against the certification that TECA offers, which has been brought to our attention through secondary inspection in New Westminster, where they're just fed up with the crap that's being installed in heating and ventilating. Wonderful change, and they're initiating it, and they've got political guts to do it, and they're making it happen. And the irony of the situation is those guys that have been warned are recognizing they've been legitimately warned, and there's been zero retaliation for this inspection.
Well, that's good. That's good news.
Yeah, it's delightfully positive. And certainly a pleasant surprise for the single inspector there that stuck his neck out and decided enough is enough.
Well, good on the city of New West for taking that on.
I have to commend this.
Yeah.
One individual is special. Jason, I won't give you the last name, but he's done a smash-up job in this.
So the other cities need to follow suit and do the same.
Well, here's the problem. The building inspector out there is a paid individual city worker. They will do what they have to do, and they're basically dictated to by the chief building inspector, but he's subservient to city council. At this moment right now, you will not find serious support for this level of inspection from City Council.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Even though our industry is fully acknowledging and recognizing the cost of inspection for HVAC and are fully willing to pay for permitting for that part of the building over and above that of the permitting the builder already pays. There is no political will right now in this province, by and large, for good heating and ventilating inspection.
Wow.
So no, they have not been dragged through the cleaners as they have with envelope failures, and therefore they do not see this as a political risk, and therefore there's very little political motivation to really step up and to provide inspection to even the minimum standard written into the BC Building Code, Section 933 and 934 today.
Oh my goodness.
It makes a complete joke of further code refinement when the weak link in the chain right now is a very lackadaisical or non-inspection right now in these two sections of the BC Building Code, which makes a little bit of a joke of busting our ass to get a really good code and good code wording when that is, at the moment, is not the weak link.
No, not at all. Wow. This is some valuable information that I knew will benefit a lot of new homeowners and people looking to purchase homes. They can go and investigate and check out these homes before they purchase them, right?
I'll tell you a story.
And ask these questions.
With the Greater Vancouver Home Building Association, started by one of my mentors, Al Coley, 35 years ago, for years and years and years, we ran seminars called What's New in Home Building. And these were run every month, and we'd get anywhere from 20 people to 100 people out, anywhere from 4 times to 10 times per year. Most of the people that go through that session could see the simplicity of what we're selling, which is a decently insulated building, built draft-free, so it isn't got raw, uncontrolled ventilation, and well-thought-out heating and ventilating. The public attention today is if you radiant heat your house, you'll get everything you need because it doesn't manufacture dust and it's comfortable, not realizing this is a complete effort to cure the symptoms and completely walks away from the problems.
Oh, wow. Wow.
I'd go nuts for hours on this topic because of the misinformation out there, and there's very little economic motivation to bring this kind of a message to a home buyer, whether it's custom or spec.
Buyer beware.
Well, in some ways, I really think we should relax and make the buyer beware, but as long as the provincial and the federal government backstop all the stupidity of UFI, leaky condos, and all the other kind of crap that's gone on, the public has become blind and lazy because they believe the government is going to look after their interests. And as a result, we've had no real groundswell support of reaching the public because they believe in these issues that are protected automatically, not recognizing that they are not.
My goodness. Yeah, we need to really pay attention, ask questions.
You won't get this message from many people because I'm old enough right now that our business is not under threat of my comments, whether I do it provincially to builders or to the Building Officials Association or with you in this interview, but you will not find very many people with a depth that will talk on these issues because generally speaking in mechanical, there's only a very small group of mechanical people of this level of conversation, although I'm surrounded with the very best out there, and the mechanical of a house so much ties to the building itself. And it's this marriage of the building and the mechanical that must be married, and very few people will know both well.
Okay, true. I can see that. So are there anything else that you think that we should know as home buyers and those living in apartment buildings? And...
Well, apartment buildings are a pig. And the reason is they're built under Part 3, and the ventilation's under Part 6. And Part 6 is so badly written, the ventilation in apartments is generally very, very bad. They overheat in the summer, they're freezing in the winter, and their ventilation is completely inadequate. But we've had no impact at TECA having any effect on these larger buildings, although gradually the developers are waking up on that issue right now. And they are, even at the provincial level now, contemplating mandatory air conditioning prevent the overheating of the southwest exposed rooms. but my comments are really focused on the single detached duplex and the secondary suite equipped homes, and that while technically it's all equivalent to the larger buildings, that's ruled under by a different section of the code.
Okay. David, can you touch on the effective leakage makeup air versus passive makeup air?
Oh, yeah, real good. The term natural ventilation is occurring, which I call raw or uncontrolled, through imperfections of the building. You've got gaps around electrical plug-ins, the electrical panel, all sorts of places in what we call the rim joist, which is the floor system, attic hatches that are leaked, pot lights that are leaked. This raw, uncontrolled ventilation is the ingress of air coming in at the bottom and leaving from the top, because that's why warm, buoyant air tends to rise just like a balloon. The balloon wicks in the sky because the top is capped, in a building they are not, and therefore they leak into the attic. Well, raw, uncontrolled ventilation is not effective because it's not getting to the bedroom and it's not doing it in a controlled manner. So it's why we call it uncontrolled or raw air exchange. The term effective is not a term that you're going to use anywhere on the street today, because everyone's talking energy efficiency, which is sort of too bad, because energy efficiency is a small sister after achieving whether your system's effective. But effective means, are you providing continuous exhaust from bathrooms? Are you providing continuous exhaust, fresh air into bedrooms? So effective is a paramount word when you're looking at different ventilation systems.
Mm-hmm.
Is it effectively meeting those goals? And that's why natural or raw or uncontrolled will never achieve those goals, because it's subject to where the leaks are in a house and the severity of the weather outside.
Wow, very interesting.
Yeah, it's a very simple physics underneath this. It's just not well understood by most people. And unfortunately, right now, there's this bandwagon approach for going green, going energy efficiency. But the pursuit of those goals isn't wrong, but it's putting the cart before the horse. You have to have a properly draft-proof, uniformly insulated building with proper heating and ventilating before you go down the energy efficiency path. And sort of the other thing that relates to this is that when you're talking about ventilation, there's no such thing as energy efficient ventilation. All ventilation systems are going to cost you money to run, and this is one of the problems of selling it.
Hmm.
You build a building that's tight and efficient and insulated, and that's what will drop your bill. But ventilating will always cost you more money. And the public doesn't want to understand that, because even the best systems with recovery will cost more than if you didn't put them in or didn't turn them on. And that's why most smart builders today use gas, because they don't want the backlash of using a fuel at three times the price of the gas.
Mm-hmm.
But the ventilation, such small potatoes when it's put in, it very seldom shows up in the bill. But I don't like people to get the false message that putting in ventilation with recovery will save them energy. It won't. It's there to improve the air quality in the house, which we cannot claim, but believe strongly it improves respiratory health.
Okay, excellent. So do you have any final comments, David, that you want to share with us?
Well, you've given me a wonderful soapbox opportunity here, Kathleen. I've covered most of the things that really tick me off, and honestly... but just basically a mirage of misinformation. And, I can leave you with one little one here.
Sure.
Have you ever heard the story about wet heat and dry heat?
No.
You know, people talk about electric baseboard heating in apartments as dry heat.
Right, yes.
Well, you know why the myth has gained traction? It's all bogus. But what happens is, when we lived in Texas for 3 years, we had three space heaters. They were natural gas, and they were in the living room, the bedroom, and the bathroom. The bathroom was the one I especially like. It was a porcelain heater. You sit in the can with your drawers down, and it wore 88s on your knees. It was just absolutely toasty.
Okay.
It's a bear getting my sisters out of the bathroom. Now, the good thing was is that these were 100% efficient because they had no chimneys. The bad thing is all the moisture produced from the use of these space heaters was released into the house, which gave the nickname that space heaters and gas is wet heat.
Mm.
So by comparison, electric's dry heat because electricity doesn't add or subtract moisture from the building. So that myth, which is actually absolute fact, and a large part of the South United States right now heats on these unit heaters without chimneys, the codes have stiffened up a little bit, that is not allowed in Canada. So when you use gas, you have to have a chimney. And when you have a chimney, you have an ongoing air exchange driven by that chimney, venting out air that pre-exists in the house 24/7 all year round. So gas heat in this country is dry heat, and electricity is wet heat by the simple fact it does not dry you out because it's got no chimney.
I hear you.
We're surrounded with so much crap that initiates from the states that we are blindly following it, with their economy being 10 times larger than our own, without thinking, where do these things fit and where are they just outright wrong?
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy.
You've been a patient listener to my tirade.
Well, it's been interesting. I've learned quite a lot today, I must say. And I just want to thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your expertise with us. And I just want to say, keep up the good work. Keep sharing.
Well, thank you for this opportunity to, shall I say, vent my frustrations on the misinformation out there today.
Thank you so much, David. Thank you.
Kathleen, it was a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoy the topic and found something that you can apply to your own life. Don't forget to share this episode with your family and friends. And remember, live well daily. Thank you.